Mammoth!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. I've got some live dates coming up. You can see me from the June the 28th to the 2nd of July at 7:15 at the Melbourne Magic Festival in a new show that I've created called Deceptology that explores the neuroscience of magic, scams, and deception. And I'd love to see you there. Anyway, on with the show. In 1995, a black and white film surfaced depicting what looked like the autopsy of an alien life form in 1940s Roswell, New Mexico. Over 17 blurry minutes, two white hooded doctors appeared to dissect a big-headed, black-eyed alien. The world, obsessed with little green men thanks to TV shows like The X-Files, went nuts. It wasn't until a decade later that British man Ray Santilli came forward to claim that he had produced the video and that it was all a hoax. However, the story doesn't end there. In recent years, Spiros Malaris, a Cyprus-born magician and special effects artist, has come forward claiming that he was the mastermind. On this week's episode of Scammapalooza, Spiros tells his side of the story in the first of two episodes dedicated to the hoax. Is Spiros telling the truth? Or is Ray Santilli? Or is the whole thing a massive cover-up designed to hide the real aliens? The truth is in here. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza.
I think we've probably got the most litigious animal in the world.
Really?
Ray Santilli is notorious, but here's the interesting twist. I'd love to see him in court. So if he, you know, if I say something he doesn't like, let's do it. Let's go to court. Because in court, you've got to speak to a judge, and I'm happy to do that, but I don't think he will be. So that's my little you know, ace up the sleeve, where he would love to sue me. He would not be able to put me in a legal arena, because the minute he does that, he's going to have to start putting proof up, and of evidence and all sorts of things, and he just hasn't got it, you know. So I'd love my day in court.
Yeah, which I guess is part of the story, is about what is the truth and what isn't the truth. That's what it's always been about.
I can tell you both sides. Yeah, I can tell you the whole thing, and. You know, you can make your own minds up, you know.
Well, let's go right back to this to begin with. What qualified you? What's your background?
That's a very good question, because I do hold a firm belief that, and I know an awful lot of people in all these different realms of life who could do parts of the film, but I've been really fortunate because I come from a magic background, so I'm a magician. So my mind works in a different way to most people. The second thing is I spent 6 years of my life working on motor vehicles and with metal and with, you know, with my hands. So I've got an engineering background, and I'm qualified as an engineer. And on top of that, I'm a filmmaker. So you stick all that together, and what it enabled me to do was to not only film and direct the autopsy, the alien autopsy, but also to make all the props that we needed, the autopsy table, and all those sort of things. And my magic background allowed me to put an element of mystery into the whole thing, so that you can suspend your disbelief and put those things together. And I think they're very unique. And it's just one of those things that happens now and again, where somebody's skills all fall into place and they do something extraordinary. And it was one of those situations where I just happened to be the right guy for the job. I was fortunate that I knew a lot of people around, you know, a lot of people around me were in the right business. For example, John Humphreys, very, very close friend of mine, number one sculptor, and at the time we were both working in film special effects. So we had all the tools and all the know-how needed to make the body of the alien. So, you know, so that's so what makes me qualified? all of that, I suppose. Well, just one more thing. When I first started out in the TV business, I was making music videos. And because I was a one-man band, I would storyboard it, film it, direct it, edit it, and deliver it. So I was the go-to guy. So I was very used to doing stuff myself. So when it came to the alien autopsy, it was a case of I'll do as much of it that I can myself and not include another member of a crew because it had to be top secret. And where I couldn't do it on my own, I would bring a choice person who could also multitask. So we kept the crew very, very small. And because it had to maintain its integrity, we couldn't allow there to be too many loose cannons because, you know, at the time, there's a lot of money in the making if you went forward with the story. So, the fact that I was making pop promos single-handedly put me in good stead.
But I guess also, as well as being the right person, it was in the right place. It was also the right time, in that the mid-90s was the perfect time to release a video like this. It was sort of just at the start of the internet, and also just at the start of the kind of international obsession with aliens and UFOs that we went through at that time. Was that something that was on your radar? Were you kind of a part of that culture and that, you know, the whole X-Files millennium,
not at all,
you know, alien
not at
invasion
all.
Obsession?
I wasn't any part of the UFO scene at all. Ray Santilli, whom I met before I made the film, was sitting around a table with a group of guys that he was working with, and they were talking about Roswell, and I don't know who, but one of the guys said, "Wouldn't it be great if there was a bit of film of an alien autopsy? You know, can you imagine if that was around?" And because they were talking about what was supposed to have happened in Roswell, and the guys, one of the guy that led them was a guy called Keith Bateman, working out of Milton Keynes in England, and they made a very jokey film of an alien autopsy. You know, it wasn't, I can't even call it an alien autopsy, although that's what they did call it. It was a boy under a sheet with a kind of a pretend paper mache head that he'd put to his head to the side and stuck there instead, a little bit like an alien, in a tent outside, you know, and they just pulled bits of guts and stuff out of this sheet, and it was very, very grainy, very, very wishy-washy, not very much detail, and it wasn't supposed to, I don't think for a second it was supposed to fool anybody. I think it was just a bit of a joke. But Santilli, being the animal that he is, he saw a penny to be made. So he took the film and started telling people that he had a film of an alien autopsy. So that's how I met him. So when I met him in Cannes, it was MIDEM in Cannes. I'm not sure if you're familiar with what MIDEM is. It's a market for music and music related product. And there's four markets in Cannes around the year. There's MIPCOM, MIPTV, MIPTV basically being television programs, MIPCOM being communications, computer and that sort of stuff. And the MIDEM would be the music one. And Ray was there, and I met him, and he sheepishly told me that he had a film of an alien autopsy, and he wanted me to make a documentary out of it. Well, obviously, I looked at him a bit funny, thinking, you know, what do you mean by an alien? You know, if somebody tells you they got a film of an alien autopsy, you know. he said, look, I bought this film from a cameraman in Roswell, and he said he filmed it in 1947, and it's supposed to be an alien body being autopsied. So I kept an open mind, although I didn't believe him, to be honest. I obviously was very skeptical, but I kept an open mind and went to his office to see the film. And within minutes of watching the film, I told him it wasn't real. And he said, well, why isn't it real? What, you know, I've paid a lot of money for it. I said, well, because it's been filmed on VHS. If at the very least, it's low band, low band pneumatic. And he said, how can you tell? And I said, well, it's my job to tell. You know, I can tell straight away. And he said, oh, no, it was film, and they put it onto VHS. And I said, no, this has got this has got camera artifacts. This is filmed on VHS. And there's certain things you can, little telltales you can tell, you know. At this point, I saw his face drop, and he thought, well, if I can't get past this idiot, who am I going to get past? You know, the first person that's seen it.
Do you believe in aliens? I mean, do you think that aliens...
I would love to say I believe in aliens, but I don't. I don't believe in aliens. I'll tell you why I don't. I've had it beaten out of me. I've interviewed 35 or so experts, people who say they were there, people who say they saw aliens, people who swore blind, and they lost credibility when they started telling me that my film was real. And the minute that they tell me my film is real, and I know it isn't, and I'm looking at them, and they're very convincing. And this is, you know, we're talking about people, military personnel, people that were in Roswell in 47. I went out there as a nobody. They didn't know who I was. I had my film with me, and I said, look, we've got this film that's supposed to be from 1947. Can you tell me what you think of it? And I filmed everybody and interviewed everyone. And you would be shocked to see how many people very convincingly told me this was what they saw. So I became very, very cynical. And whilst I want to believe that, let's rephrase it. I think there are aliens out there. I just don't think they're close enough to get to us. I think that's a better way to put it, because the amount of speed that they would have to travel at to get to where we are, knowing what we know, okay, knowing just going to the moon or just going to Mars, we haven't even left our own galaxy. We know how long that takes, and we know the energy it takes, and we know, in human terms, we know that we can't go and visit a galaxy further than our own, because we just won't live long enough. We wouldn't be able to tolerate the G-force necessary to go faster to get there in time. So if we allow that the aliens do have the ability to travel that speed, and that's why I made the alien in my film, I made a bit more insect-like in its interior, in its design of its guts, so that it would be more of a, you know, I kind of looked at lots of half-truths, and I thought, well, everybody knows that in the event of radioactivity, an explosion, what have you, the cockroaches will survive. Everyone's heard that. So I figured, okay, if I made the interior of the intestines and what have you of the alien more insect-like, then that would allow them to travel faster. But even so, because we don't know what we're dealing with, we don't know what the aliens are capable of. What I do know, and this is the bit that does it for me, I mean, just blows it away for me, is that every time they come here, they crash. Okay, they have the ability to come all that distance and at that speed and with that technology, but they can't land the bloody thing, you know. Because I don't know if you're aware, there's about 4 crash sites in Roswell or around the area. 4 crash sites. So they're just coming along and crashing. Doesn't make sense.
If Ray Santilli was going to fool someone, it would need to be you, someone like you, someone who knew how to fake it all and was a massive skeptic when it came to aliens and UFOs. That was really the goal then of the footage, was not, you know, like you said, not something made out of paper mache with a small child in it. It had
Absolutely.
To be
not
real
that,
enough to fool someone
to have,
like you.
See, I'm not an expert, but I know enough about little bits, okay, so that I can draw from a vast amount of little bits of knowledge. So I'm not a doctor, I'm not an alien expert, I'm not, you know, but I do know about human biology, I do know about, you know, so I know enough to say, well, this doesn't make sense, or if it does make sense, that's enough for me to hang my hat on and say, okay, I'm going to let it be for a while, it could be real. As long as I can say, well, I don't know, is a win. Not an immediate dismissal. So So when we made the film, we made sure that it had lots and lots of elements that made people say, okay, well, I'm not sure if I believe it, but it might be real because of this, and it might be real because of that. And when you tick all the boxes, it slowly overweighs the maybe it's a fake. It becomes more real because there's too much going for it. So if I can just elaborate on that, for example, we said it was made in 1947, and we had it evaluated by Kodak. So Kodak said it shows a square and a triangle, which tells us it could be 1947. Okay, but the square and the triangle was used every 20 years, so it could be 1927, 1947, or 1967. Okay, so they were the years that a square and a triangle were used on 16 millimeter film. So it could be 47. Now, we've got to leave it wide open. It might be 27, might be 67, and based on other tests, we can evaluate that. But it's still in the ballpark. Okay, so far, it could be real. Then we look at the creature itself, and we say, is this possible that this is a fake body? Is it a special effect? So we talk to the special effect experts, and they will tell us that, well, if this is a 1967 film at the latest, then we didn't have special effects good enough to make this film in 1967. So it can't be a fake in terms of special effects if the film is genuine 47, 67. So see how where I'm going. It's one step at a time.
It sounds like you're offering lots of clues that point towards it's being real without ever trying too hard.
That's right. Most of the people that you'll ever, if you read up on sightings of alien beings, the most commonplace one, they call them the Greys. And the Greys are quite thin, very spindly. They've got three fingers and a thumb or a claw. And they're not like the alien on my film. And that was very deliberate because I don't think that an alien would... I don't believe an alien would look like a Grey. I think that's a man-made myth. I don't think that's real. But more importantly, it doesn't matter what I think. The fact that the alien that we made on our film is more—it's a more logical being. It's got a thick neck to hold a big head. You know, it's not got a big head and a little spindly neck. That's not logical, unless there's nothing in the head, unless it's very light. You and me. So we made it very logical. So biologically, it was logical. However, it goes against what everyone else says an alien looks like. So the double whammy there is, well, if this is a hoax, why would they go against what everyone says an alien looks like? Why would they not go for the easy route, which is just make an alien like the one that everyone says they saw? And then there's no dispute. But to have six fingers and six toes and the other bits and pieces that weren't a match, if you like, on the eyewitness reports, That has a double negative effect, which is it's a double bluff, you know. It has a double bluff where, well, it's nothing like anyone else that says they saw it, so therefore it must be real because a hoaxer wouldn't go against the grain.
It's not about creating evidence. It's about creating mystery and about creating questions that people want to answer. And of course, you point them in the direction of the answer that you want. Sort of leading a horse to water. How do you get though from this conversation you have with Ray Santilli? We're in at the conference in Cannes. To you're in a studio making this fake video.
Okay, so what happened was I left Ray's office that afternoon, having seen this very bad film, and I was in the car driving home, and I called John Humphreys, and I said, John, you should have seen this film. We could have done better with our feet. And he laughed and he said, well, why don't we? So it just said, okay. So I picked the phone up again and the phone back, phoned Ray back. And I said, look, Ray, I can make this for you properly. Is there a deal we can do? And he said, well, what have you got in mind? And I said, well, for me, it'll be creating the ultimate illusion that a magician has ever perpetrated on man. So I want to just hit the maximum amount of people with the biggest illusion I can possibly create. And then I want to have a ta-da moment where I can say, ta-da, this is how we did it. And that's what my motivation was. Could we fool the world? The motivation for Santilli was, of course, financial. You know, he wanted to make money. So, of course, yeah.
Did he say that openly to you, at the time, that he wanted to make cash?
It was an element of, let's have some fun with this. But very shrewdly, he said to me, who are you going to use in the film? And I said, I don't know yet. I need to think about it very carefully and see how many people we actually need and who we can trust. And he said, well, whoever we have, we've got to sign non-disclosure agreements because no one must speak about it until the film recoups its money, until it makes back what it costs. So I agreed that would be fine. That would be the right thing to do. Not realizing that he would never recoup. You know, he just didn't tell us when he got paid. Classic. But
it's just like classic Hollywood accounting. This is all brilliant because these are the same sorts of techniques which you're using to make the film are also being to stop you from getting paid.
The case
for the
of
film
a few,
as well.
If we're telling people it's real,
yeah,
then we've got no right to it. It's not our copyright. It's the U.S. government's copyright. You see? So, and it made sense. And I thought, oh, it's terrible, you know. So, I'd be in France one time. I saw it on television. In Italy, I saw it on television. It was all over the world. Now, at the time, he was selling it. But I had no knowledge of that. I had no way of knowing. And he just strung us along. And the other thing that was very pertinent, of course, was I was working with Santilli quite closely over the years. And I made a lot of money working for him, you know, making different TV shows and what have you for him. So he was a good source of income for me through other projects. So we never fell out over it because we were quite close. So he never recouped the money and we never spoke. So it lasted 15 years. So 15 years of maintaining its integrity. And it only became, we only told the world that it was fake after the 15 years when Santilli made Anton Deck's movie. Are you familiar with that? Yeah, you know about that.
I am. And so it's basically I mean, we'll get to that in a second, but it's basically a comedy about the alien autopsy video that is very much from Santilli's perspective.
Yeah,
I guess is the fair way of saying it. It's his story, and he was an executive producer on the
yeah.
Film.
He's basically what he did was they came to my office. Santilli and Shufield came to my office and they said, "We've been offered a movie. Do you fancy doing it? Do you think we should do it?" And bear in mind, it was 15 years on. And we hadn't seen any money. We hadn't recouped. And I said to Santilli, how much are they paying? And he said, oh, no, they're not paying anything. We're just going to do it for fun. So I just laughed and said, well, don't we have enough fun as it is? You know, why would we give it away after 15 years of you telling me we haven't broken even for fun, for a major movie? So he said, okay, so you don't want to do it. I said, no, I don't think we should do it. Now, what I meant was, I don't think we should do it. So they left my office and did it without me.
Oh, well, I don't think it made a huge amount of money.
You know what? It could have been a brilliant film. But what they did was they cut out all the story and they made it the Gary and Ray show. And by default, it lacked meat. There was no meat on the bone because the story was thin. What really happened was an amazing...
Oh, sorry, you just cut out there.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, what I said is that what really happened was a great film. But what they did was they didn't have the insight. They didn't have the insider information to write a proper script because they'd cut me out of it. I was the only person that knew every part of the film. My ex-girlfriend played the nurse in the film, and she also did the research, and she also did the costumes. So I designed the costumes, but she stitched them together. So she knew her bits, but she didn't know anything about anything else. John and I made the body, and we made the debris. You know, have you seen the debris footage?
Yeah.
So we made all the bits and for the debris footage. So John and I did the body and the debris footage, and that's all John knew. He knew nothing about the research other than what we told him, and also he didn't know anything about the costumes or any of that. I built the set. I built the autopsy table, and I acquired all the bits from America, the clock, the telephone, all those sort of things. So nobody else was party to that. So the only person that knew every aspect was myself, because it was me with the relevant person. So if you were to go to one person and say, tell me the story, if it wasn't me, you'd only get their part. And that's quite thin on the ground, you know, when you look at the whole picture.
Yeah. So let's get some more of that story. So, in fact, why don't we, because we're sort of at a point now where we've actually got the footage, is you sort of, you know, you've agreed with Santilli to make this footage and to, you know, get the, you know, put it all together, and you've got Humphreys on board to help with it. How did you construct the alien? Like, what is the alien made out of?
John at the time was working at a studio called Murphy's. Now, Murphy's did a lot of film special effects. And bear in mind, we had to make this in complete secrecy. What John did was he did a lot of the heavy-duty work at Murphy's, but it gave nothing away. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. John has twins. He's got a little boy and a girl. And Michael, who at the time was 10 years old, very tall kids, you know, their mother's over 6 foot tall. All her family, all her side of the family are over 6 foot tall. So the kids, the 10-year-olds, are like 5 foot tall. So he molded Michael in a molding material. It's called alginate. It's used for dental. Molding. And then on top of that, there's a special foam that you put on, like a liquid latex, a very thick foam. And then you build a fiberglass shell on the outside of that. Once you've made the mold, you can then press a plaster version of Michael. So the first thing that happened was at Murphy's, John made the positive of Michael in plaster. We then transported that positive to a house in Camden Town in London where we were working. And John then sculpted the alien features on top of Michael's basic body. So because Michael's is obviously a 10-year-old little boy, so he was quite thin. So we were able to pad out muscular features on the arms, on the shoulders, make the head bigger. So we're literally adding clay to the existing body. But what it does, it gives you good proportions, you know, as a basis. John sculpted into the feet the extra toe, and into the hands the extra finger. And it was beautiful. I mean, it was just very organic. Everything looked very, very good. And once the clay version was sculpted, then a new mold is made. And that mold is the mold of the alien, okay, because the clay will dry and crack if you left it. So you have to mold it straight away. That negative then becomes the mold for the alien creature. The eyes were painted in with using an enamel paint, and then we painted on top of that a latex skin. So we put some KY jelly inside the eye, on the surface of the eye, and then painted in a latex skin on top. So when you saw the eye of the alien, it looked like the black almond eyes that everyone knows an alien looks like. But the doctor who's doing the autopsy notices that it's a lens, and he peels it away with a pair of tweezers, revealing the eye underneath. And that's one of those instances where you think, well, that makes sense. You know, if you're watching that film and it's all gunky and it's modern sunglasses, it makes sense that they've got black eyes for a purpose, because as human beings and as people that, you know, if you ask an optometrist, a doctor, who anybody who knows about the human body, they'll tell you that an eye has an iris and a lens and a, you know, a pupil. All those things make up a piece of equipment that can let you see. It's like a camera lens can see. It has the same principle. Well, just one black eye doesn't make logical sense. And there's two schools of thought. The first one is, we don't have to understand it. That's how aliens are. They can see. Get over it, right? Yeah. That's one way.
That's a great explanation for anything. Is it's an alien. It doesn't have to make
sense. That's right. Now, you can do that if you want to. But if you're trying to make a hoax and you want people to believe it, just saying it's like that just because we say so and lump it if you don't like it isn't a very good convincer. But if you are able to go with the flow and say, yes, they have got black eyes like you thought they had, but we were all fooled. They're not eyes at all. They're lenses. And look, the doctor's removing the lens, and underneath there's an eye that we understand. And it all makes sense. And a hoaxer wouldn't waste their time and go to extreme lengths to show you something that nobody wants to see. Because we're quite happy with the black almond-shaped eyes. That's what an alien is. We don't need to go anymore. The minute you show us more, it's over and above the call of duty.
You're admitting things that look like they're harming your argument, but in doing so, you're helping them.
Yes, and because of that, people looking are more likely to say, "God, that's amazing. That makes total sense now." And because it looked real, because it looks so real, and because of the KY lining inside, when you peel it off and it you can actually see the gunk. It looks like it's something organic. It doesn't look like a rubber doll. It looks like this is a living thing. This is something that's liquid. You know, it's not just a solid plastic thing. So it's just layers of depth which go over and above the call of duty. And if you keep doing that again and again and again and again, eventually it's like this has to be real. Because
I have heard though some of the elements were fixing mistakes. The leg wound, I understand, and I'm not sure this is true or not, but the leg wound wasn't meant to be there, but there was a problem.
That's right.
And
that's right.
The leg wound was a way of basically covering up for a flaw in the design.
No. What happened was we made an alien, the first alien, and we filmed it. And it was perfect. Everything was lovely, right? The leg was perfect. Everything was amazing. And I was in the editing stage, and my girlfriend came to the studio, and she said, "Stop what you're doing. We've got to do it again." And I said, "Well, what do you mean, got to do it again? It's perfect, you know." She said, "No." She said, "This will be found out within a week," and because she found out that. The only person in Roswell at the time who had top clearance who would be able to conduct an autopsy of this nature in that base was a guy called Dr. Bronk. And Dr. Bronk was a surgeon. And we filmed the alien autopsy as if it was done by a pathologist. And that very fine point is why an expert would look at it and say it's a fake, because there wasn't a pathologist with top secret credentials at that time on that spot. So this has to be a fake. The people that made this weren't in the know. But the fact that it was a surgeon uses different techniques to a pathologist. One's trained to save lives, the other one doesn't care, it's already dead. So it's very, very different technique. So we had to make another body, and we had to do it again. Now we've just wasted nearly 4 or 5 days, and we were on the cusp, but we had to do it quickly because we're running out of time. Santilli had already promised to show the film. So we made, and it's back to timing. You know, when you put the latex into the mold, that has to cure, and then you put in the bubbling foam, and that has to cure. Mm. But if you don't give it enough time, these things, they don't expand fully. You get air bubbles trapped in, you know, you have to put little by little into each leg and let it roll down to the feet. If you don't take your time and do that properly, what happens is you could get an air bubble stuck in the foot, so that everything else is, it expands and is solid, and the foot is flat and floppy because there's nothing in it, you see. Well, that happened on the knee on the right hand leg. There was an air bubble, so we pulled the body of the alien out of the mold, and there was a big air bubble on the right knee. So we didn't have time to make another one. So I told John to go to the butcher's and get a knuckle, anything, a sheep leg with a joint, a knuckle, or beef, anything, any leg. And he actually brought back a sheep's leg. And by the time he came back, I'd opened up the knee, created a wound, and then we inserted the bones of the animal joint into the leg and into the thigh, and then latexed it inside and dressed it. So basically it looked like it had been shot or it had an accident, you know, in the crash. But that wound, yes, it was really a case of covering up an air bubble.
That's the part that I remember, is that leg wound. The face and the opening up the guts, always, to me, when I first saw the footage as a teenager, that always felt quite... you know, it felt real, but it felt familiar.
Yeah.
Whereas there was something quite otherworldly about this kind of gaping wound in the leg that reminded me of those old Faces of Death movies. It felt quite, yeah, that was the thing that made me, you know, send shivers down my spine, was that gaping, blackened leg wound.
Yeah.
So once you'd finished the shooting and you'd produced this video, you then had to go back and do it a second time, as you said, and repeat the whole thing again. Now, I understand, so Santilli and his backers paid for that first shooting, but you say that you actually paid for the second shoot.
That's right.
The one that we know.
It's actually my saving grace today, because it's funny how things work. But Volker Spielberg, who was a guy that we worked with, funded the first movie for the Alien Autopsy. So it was £35,000, and he funded the first movie. The first movie was flawed because of the surgeon pathologist detail. So when I told Ray that it wasn't going to get through, it wasn't going to stand up to any criteria, any scrutiny. He then said, "Oh, well, we haven't got any more money. We can't do it again. So that's it. You know, we'll just have to make the best that we can, and that's it." So I explained to him that he mustn't show it, because if he shows it, it's going to be exposed immediately, that it's not real. It won't take much time at all. So I said to him, I'm going to make it again. And he said, well, there's no more money. So I said, I'm going to do it myself, and we'll just do it properly. So I took it upon myself to do it again. So I paid for all the extra materials and what have you to make a new body and run it all again. So the way that sits now is, I was originally on the first movie the writer, director, producer, editor, cameraman, and set designer. And on the second one, I was all of those things, but I was also executive producer, which is the guy that put the money up. So the copyright, in terms of who owns the copyright of the second movie, is me. The first movie, Santilli will argue that he's executive producer on the first movie, and therefore he shares the copyright with me. But the movie...
Is there a contract anywhere?
Well, the contracts that we had obviously don't talk about an alien autopsy. It was crazy to do that because obviously it was supposed to be secret. But the only reason that Santilli has ever got an argument today is because I'm an honourable person. Because had I not been honourable, I could have just blown it out of the water a long time ago. I could have kept photographs of us making it, and you know, and we specifically agreed we would not hold anything back, so that Santilli was safe. You know, he said I mustn't get out before I recoup my money. I even attended the film lab when the film was developed. I was at the film lab at midnight and literally walking the film through the machines and picking it up the other side. Because, you know, I don't know if you realize, but each reel, camera reel, is about 3 minutes long, three and a half minutes long. And what happens is they put it through the machine, through the chemicals and what have you. It's then developed. Rather than do it in small reels of 50 feet, they splice each bit of film together to create a 300-foot reel, for example. And then all of that goes in one go. So you're not having to put in, you know, feed new bits of film in again and again and again. It just goes, you feed it in once and it just does it in one go. So every time you splice a 50-foot reel to another 50-foot reel, you have to cut a few frames off, rough it up, and stick it together. So what falls to the floor are two or three frames of that film. And at that time, any single frame of that alien being was worth somewhere in the region of £20,000 to the News of the World, to the newspaper. So I couldn't afford to have a single frame on the cutting room floor that somebody else may pick up. So I literally sat there and went and followed it through the machines, picked up everything as it fell to the floor, put it in a little envelope, and collected every little piece and took it with me that evening. So at no time did the film leave my sight, and at no time did any part of it stay in the lab. So that's how careful I was. I could have very easily sold one of those frames for $20,000 before anyone else ever saw it. But I'm an honourable person. What can I say? That's what I agreed to do. That's what I did. And it's now proved to my detriment that had I done a little bit of a sneaky and kept a bit more stuff behind, it would make my life a lot easier for sure. John Humphreys did keep a few pieces aside. He took a few Polaroids and stuff. So although I was very upset with him at the time, when I found out he'd done it, I'm actually quite pleased that I've got that now. But it was the security that was impeccable, you know.
And at this point, once you've created the film, you've gotten rid of the evidence as much as you can. Did you essentially hand it to Santilli and he then sort of leaked it to the world?
Yeah.
How did it get out there? How did people find out about it?
So what happened was, after the first autopsy was done, Santilli said, look, I've got these researchers coming down. They need to see something. I promised them to show them something. And he said, I won't show them the entire film. I'll just show them segments, and they won't know. These guys won't know the difference between a pathologist and a surgeon, but they need to see something. So we agreed that he would show them little bits of the first autopsy. And these people were a select few. One person, a guy called Maurizio Baita, who's an Italian ufologist. Another guy was Philip Mantle, who's a British ufologist. He also showed the singer from the Troggs, a guy called Reg Presley. You know the Troggs, the band? Wild Thing, and you know, so he saw the first autopsy, and whilst he was getting rid of people that he promised to show the film to and getting them off his back, we made the second autopsy. When I gave him the second autopsy, it was already edited into what we now know to be the alien autopsy. And it was very carefully edited, so it flashes to white at the end of each reel. And every single flash in that film has a purpose. You know, it's there for a reason. So he took that film and then released it into the world. He showed it to a close community in a theatre. And then it was sold to various TV channels and stuff all over the world. So Santilli was basically a distributor of the film from day one.
And once it caught fire, and once it did catch on, and once people started sharing it and talking about it, did he need to do anything else? I mean, did he need to, or did it just take on a life of its own? Because I remember at the time it was everywhere and everyone was talking about it. It showed up in an episode of Seinfeld, I think. I mean, obviously the X-Files mentioned it a couple of times.
One of my favorite things. It was a real boost for me, especially it was a real buzz when Seinfeld was one of my favorite shows, and to sit there and see Kramer and Newman talking about my film was unbelievable. But yeah, it got everywhere. People were doing spoofs of it. As you say, it was, you know, 1.2 billion people had seen that image, and you know, there were documentaries made in every country of the world. It was in the front page of every magazine and every paper. I've collected them over the years. Loads and loads of models and games and toys and all sorts of things, all based around the alien autopsy. It certainly did the rounds. But, Santilli maintained the whole time that he wasn't selling it. He wasn't making any money at all. And the funny thing is, you know, and it's going to sound crazy. I know you're going to think I'm not on the level, but I'm going to say it anyway because I really am. I wasn't in it for the money. You know, I happen to know Santilli made millions. You know, there's no exaggeration, and I wasn't in it for the money. You know, I did it because I know pretty much every magician that's out there, you know, in the world, all the big names. I know them all. And I wanted to do something that was going to make them all sit and watch it and go, oh, my God, wow. And that's why I was in it. Nothing else, you know. And
sure, but if there's money to be made, you're not going to turn it down as an artist.
Absolutely. Give me the money. If there's money, give me the money. But that isn't my motivation. My motivation was never, let's do this and make loads of money. That was never my motivation to do it. It wasn't John's motivation. You know, we did it to see if we could do it, you know, and we did it as well as we could do it. Everyone who was involved, I mean, my girlfriend, we'll call her Geraldine, okay, because she wants to remain anonymous. We'll call her Geraldine. She researched every little aspect of what this had to be. And she went to medical libraries to research how an autopsy is done in 1947 in America, you know, because in the UK, an autopsy was different from how they did it in America. And the tools they used were different. You know, we had to get an autopsy kit as used in 1940s in America. The difference in America, there were totally stainless steel handles and blades, where in England we had wooden handles. So we couldn't just go and get an autopsy tool kit from the UK and use it in this film, because immediately an expert would say these aren't the tools that would have been used in 1947. So lots and lots and lots of little detail that you and I would never think of, you know. And she kept coming back with all sorts of very, very fine detail to say this has to be just so, or it won't get through. It won't get past a specific expert, you know. And that was down to the autopsy tool kits, also down to the suits that we were wearing, the frame rate that I filmed at, everything. I mean, you know, there are things like light frequencies that flash in between frames. You know, if you're using a fluorescent light tube, for example, the amount of hertz that go through a tube and the rate that you film at can be counted, and then the film can be discredited. That's how fine the detail is. So, you know, and I didn't know, because I'm no expert. I'm first to admit it. I'm no expert when it comes to all these things, but I'm aware of the tests that they will do. So the clock on the wall is a genuine 1946 American clock, and it ran 110 volts. And I wired in the set of the autopsy to be 110 volts. So everything that ran off that room was genuinely 110 volts. So if anyone did have the wherewithal to count how that second hand is moving, or how the minute hand is moving in conjunction with how many throbs of light there are in between each frame, it was correct. You understand?
I know there's some people were researching whether those spiral telephone cords that you can, there's a telephone with a spiral,
yes,
cord, and there was someone trying to research what year they were first introduced to America and all the different brands to see,
absolutely,
whether that would provide evidence.
Well, you know,
there was another one which was someone who like freeze framing and trying to, because they thought they could see the word freedom written in Greek hidden somewhere in the video.
Yeah, it's on
all
the,
sorts
it's
of
on
little
the,
Easter eggs for people.
Yeah,
to
that's actually on the I beams in the debris footage. Getting back to the phone, when I bought the phone, it had a straight wire on it, and the girl who found the phone for me in America said to me, I don't know if this is useful for you, but I told her where we were making a film about hospitals. It was like in a hospital. And so I thought it would be the right kind of thing, you know. And I said to her, so I wanted to be between 45 and 47, early 47. So she found the phone and she said, I don't know if it's any use to you, but there's an upgrade kit for the phone. And I said to her, what do you know about it? She says, well, most hospitals and government institutions had this upgrade, and it was available from 1946. So I said, okay, so what does it involve? And she said, well, it's got a little Baker-like cup that goes onto the phone on the mouthpiece, and there's a curly wire, and there's a little thing that goes on the handle that you can put it on your shoulder, so you can hold the phone on your shoulder so your hand's free. And that kit was an extra that you got, okay? So I did a research myself, and I found that, indeed, that was available in 1946. But most people would say the curly wire wasn't available in 47, which is true. Majority of places, homes, for example, wouldn't have a curly wire. So it was a perfect fuse to put into the film, because somebody would say it's a fake because the wire's curly, and an expert would say, no, it isn't a fake. It's actually correct in the location this phone is supposed to be in.
But the important thing is people are talking about,
that's
it,
right,
which is
and,
what you
and
want.
They, yeah. And they're thinking it's fake, and then they're finding out it isn't. And the more you do that, the more you create, they let go. After a while, when you keep saying, oh, it's fake because of this, oh, it isn't, oh, it's a fake, oh, it isn't, you actually start to lose momentum. So you start to stop doing that, because it's maintaining its integrity the whole time. And the more you do that, the more you find, okay, it's looking real because of that. If you know anything about these ufologist guys, these UFO researchers, they're some of them are very, very meticulous, and they look at stuff that you and I wouldn't look at. And because of that, I did an awful lot in that film that didn't need to be there. If you were to look at the film at the beginning, when it first starts, the film swings up from the floor and it sweeps past the wall. And then for the first time, you see the autopsy table with the alien. But as it goes up the wall, you see a dark area, something on the wall as it goes up. If you freeze frame that, you will see that's a Bakelite American electric outlet that's there. And it's shot in such a way that it's just a throwaway. You'd miss it if you didn't know. And that one thing didn't need to be there. But it's there because it would be there. And if you're looking at just the alien, then that's where all your focus would be. But I kind of felt the surrounding of the alien needs to be as authentic as the alien itself. So every time you look at stuff which is not the alien, it has to be correct and it has to be authentic and it has to fit within what you're saying this scene is. So there's lots there, there's lots hidden, and I call these little elements fuses. You know, the theory of a fuse is if you have cables, for example, in a brick wall covered in plaster, the last thing you want is for the cable to burn inside the wall where the plaster is behind the plaster, because you can't get to it to fix it. So what you do is you create a weak point so that it blows where you want it to blow so that you can repair it. Okay, so in the case of a traditional fuse, it would blow at the fuse, you would take the fuse out, put a new fuse in, and then you're off you go again. So it's never going to go anywhere else than where you want it to go. Same with a hoax, such as the alien autopsy. I want you to blow exactly where I want you to be so that I can control you. Because if you blow inside that wall, I can't control you. You could go areas that I haven't covered. I could be in a lot of hot water because I'm not in control of you. And the same with any magic effect, you know. If I don't control my audience, they can run riot and look at and see things that I don't want them to see. But if my misdirection is good, they only see what I show them. Okay? So with the curly wire on the telephone, I've got you looking where I want you to look, and where you're looking is safe for me. So I quite like the idea you're going to waste your time thinking it's a hoax because of that curly wire and then finding out that it isn't, because you haven't been spending too much time looking at things that matter. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Okay. So if I put a Bakelite power outlet in a shot which looks like it's a throwaway shot, it's not important. If we cut that clip out, the alien autopsy would not be any worse. Okay, you would miss nothing. The fact that's included just allows you to say, well, okay, well, I can see that there's things in this room that are not even in shot which are authentic. And what they serve to do is date the film and also place it in a certain part of the world. So if it's an American electronic outlet and it's Bakelite, we can date it and we know it's in America. So those little things all mount up for the big things. The two major things that I can say to you that if you were to believe, and there's a lot of people that still believe the alien autopsy is real, and I'm being paid by the Men in Black to say that it's not real. That's actually a genuine thing. I've got emails every single day from people telling me that, you know, I'm trying to cover up the whole thing, and I've been paid to say these things. And to those people, I just say, we've got the internet. we've got Yahoo and Google and a number of search engines. And if you wanted to look at alien, if you wanted to look at autopsy tables, for example, you could just go Google autopsy tables, and a number of autopsy tables would come up from all over the world, different times of the world, yes? And you will never find one that's like the one in the alien autopsy, okay? Which goes against any logic at all, because if this was a military institution in America, it wouldn't be a one-off autopsy table. There would be others like it in other medical journals. There would be in other institutions. There would be in hospitals. There would be around different places, because you don't rig up to make one table. You know, if you manufacture something, the person that manufactures that table manufactures a few. You know, it wouldn't be just the one. It would be in a catalogue somewhere. You know, so if you, every other table you look at, that is true. What I'm telling you is absolutely true. There are other examples of that table in other journals. That table in the alien autopsy is unique because I made it. There is no other one anywhere in the world, not in history.
I think that's great, because, I mean, that's an example of how... Okay, so since 1995 to 2006, when Santilli admitted that it was, well, sort of admitted that it was a hoax, you were dedicated to making people believe that this was real, either by what you were doing, you know, the construction and editing of the video, or just keeping quiet about it. Whereas now, from 2006 on, you're having to work very, very hard to convince people to undo your own work.
That's right.
And
that's
to convince you're having to go through and point out the flaws in your own, in your
it's
argument.
Ridiculous.
You're having to do interviews like this to point out that no, it's fake. So you are, I mean, you know, you are essentially a victim of your own success.
I know, it serves me right. The fallout suits that the doctors were wearing, they won't, you won't find any like those anywhere in the world in history, because we made them. And again, that's another example. There would be other examples of fallout suits, because they were used in all sorts of situations, in radiation experiments and in labs and what have you. There, you know, and the telltale signs that they're not genuine fallout suits are quite clear. The visors, the little windows for them to see through, I had to make uncomfortably small, because I didn't have the luxury of letting you see who was inside that suit. So otherwise they'd be recognized. So I made the visor's window very, very small, and it's actually illogical. You wouldn't make a window that small to do something this delicate. You wouldn't be able to work. You know, you just can't see. Every other example of a fallout suit that you will find, they've got a big square visor. It's a very quite a big window. So that's one telltale. But more importantly, there's no way of the people that are wearing those suits for them to breathe. And that was a problem when we were filming, because they couldn't breathe. It was a sealed suit. They would, in reality, they would either have gas bottles on the back of the person's back, or they would have a hose to a boot. You will not find any footage at all in the alien autopsy where you can see the people's boot. And the reason for that is because I knew there would have to be a hose attached to their boot, so I avoided filming their feet. So coupled with the fact that you don't see the feet and there's no gas to the back, it just adds up little by little by little, starts to make it more implausible. We actually had it did get to a point where they were holding their breath for between shots, and each reel lasted 3.5 minutes. So I would start filming and I would have to stop because they couldn't breathe, and then pick up again from where we left last time. It was a bit of a problem, because obviously John couldn't breathe, Geraldine couldn't breathe. I was wearing the same suit, but because again, a little knowledge, you know, I knew that you know, anyone investigating a scene would look at reflective surfaces, you know, like any chrome dishes or glassware or whatever, and they would see the person who's filming, and they would see what's in the room behind the camera. So we had to make sure that everything was correct for the time. So I couldn't be, for example, holding a modern camera wearing a Nike T-shirt, because it would be seen. Although I'm not in the film, a reflection of me would appear somewhere. And as it happens, NASA did look at the film in very fine detail for all the reflective surfaces and all that sort of stuff. So we were bang on the money, you know, we were bang on the money in that respect. But I was wearing the same suit as the other guys were while I was filming. And I was actually filming with the exact camera that would have been used at that time as well. So everything was correct. But because the back of my suit wasn't visible, I was able to just have a slit in the back of the helmet so I could breathe. But the others didn't have that luxury because I was filming front, back, sideways. You saw every angle. So they were really being punished, really being tortured.
On next week's episode of Scammapalooza, Spiros talks more about behind the scenes, his falling out with Santilli, and the cultural impact of the video. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this has been Scammapalooza.